Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today seems like as good a time as any to ask the following question. When is enough enough? $350 billion in bailout money is already spoken for. Today, just as the Senate votes on the second $350 and the House tries to tighten up the rules, we learn Bank of America needs more help. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 15th of January. Great to have you here. Bank of America. For the past couple of months, it's been one of the good banks, in good enough shape to buy the failed mortgage lender Countrywide last summer, big enough not to need money from the TARP, but CEO Ken Lewis took $15 billion anyway just to make everybody else feel okay about it, healthy enough to buy Merrill Lynch when it was going under back in September, and, oh, by the way, getting Merrill's $10 billion in TARP money as a sweetener. Now, though, we know all was not as it seemed. Even before the books were closed on 2008, B of A went back to the Treasury to report problems with that Merrill deal. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Reports indicate that Bank of America asked the government for additional funds last month. The bank said its deal with Merrill Lynch was in danger because Merrill's results looked far worse than expected. So Uncle Sam promised Bank of America more money, and the deal went through. But what happened to the original $25 billion in TARP money? Christopher Whalen is a partner at Institutional Risk Analytics.
Primarily, it's been used for absorbing losses. You know, all three of the top banks have different problems, but they all are seeing loss rates for both securities and loans going up.
He says the government shouldn't extend any further largesse to the bank.
If we keep putting money in the big banks, where we're essentially just covering operating losses, but we're not dealing with the solvency issue, we're just buying time.
But Jamie Peters, an equity analyst at Morningstar, says the government will pony up the extra funds.
We've seen in this series of bailouts that the government doesn't want these two large to fail institutions to actually fail. And so stepping in and bailing out Bank of America is pretty much the only option.
Peters says the government's likely to inject capital in return for preferred shares, among other things.
Bank of America's dividend probably going to go away, practically down to a cent a share.
The bank announces fourth quarter earnings next week. Peters says for the first time in many years, it's expected to report a loss. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
If, in fact, Bank of America does get help closing the Merrill deal, and we're not going to know officially until it reports earnings next week, as Ashley told us, CEO Ken Lewis isn't going to be the only happy banker around. JPMorgan Chase and Wells Fargo also tapped into the TARP to ease their acquisitions of smaller competitors. Competitors, we should say, whose books might have been just as bad as Merrill's. Given that, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman looked into whether there might be some buyer's remorse on the way.
JPMorgan Chase and Wells Fargo each got $25 billion to make it easier for them to take over WaMu and Wachovia, along with all the bad loans sitting on their books. With loan losses continuing to mount throughout the financial system, Chase and Wells Fargo could face some of the same trouble as B of A, says Bernie McGinn of McGinn Investment Management.
All of the banks that have taken over other banks are going to have heartburn.
Still, says McGinn, Merrill Lynch, as an investment bank, came with more potential trouble. WaMu and Wachovia were traditional straight-ahead banks.
Merrill Lynch is a more dynamic, more risky company than, say, Wachovia was. And a straight bank also comes with deposits, okay? And J.P. Morgan can be helped by the deposits.
We had evidence of that today, with J.P. Morgan reporting a small profit, thanks in part to operations at WaMu. Brian Bethune, chief U.S. financial economist at IHS Global Insight, says these TARP-facilitated bank mergers remain a good deal now as they were in the first go-round.
Wachovia and Washington Mutual were caught in a general run against the banks. What happened was first-tier banks such as J.P. Morgan purchased banks in the second tier to try and eliminate some of the systemic risk.
Nonetheless, Bethune predicts that there will be more trips to the TARP trough in coming months, including possibly by Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan Chase, as banks continue to write off bad assets and buy up their weaker rivals. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker addressed the financial industry issue of the day today, those ever-growing banks. At a conference in New York, Volcker, and a group of financial heavy hitters unveiled a whole raft of proposals to reform the industry. And there is some serious reforming to be done. Those recommendations touch on everything from reining in hedge funds to restructuring Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Marketplace's Amy Scott was there.
Paul Volcker had one four-letter word to sum up the state of the banking system.
Beginning with M. It's a mess.
Volcker is part of the Group of 30. Its members are corporate leaders, academics, and former regulators. Today, they proposed stronger oversight of systemically important institutions, that is, banks, hedge funds, and insurance companies whose failure could compromise the entire financial system. Volcker says Adam Smith advised never letting an institution get that big.
I think that advice, which may have been suitable for 1776 in Scotland, would be a little hard to apply in the United States and other modern economies.
Instead, Volcker and company say regulators should limit the risks those institutions can take and force them to keep more cash on hand. John Deary is executive vice president of the Financial Services Forum, a Wall Street trade group. The industry has long resisted increased regulation, but Deary says he welcomes better regulation.
You don't want to put a financial sector in the box and regulate out of the system its capacity for innovation, its capacity for being competitive. At the same time, how do you strike that balance with the need for a safe and sound system?
Deary says the Group of 30 reforms seem to strike that balance, and he suspects many of them will eventually become policy. As an advisor to the incoming Obama administration, Volcker has the ear of the president-elect. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
How about we take a break from our regularly scheduled news for an economic number not related to banks? How about that? Negative 1.9% is the number. That was the change in the producer price index that was announced this morning. It was also the fifth straight month of declines, which has added to deflation to an already long list of economic worries. There were some early worries on Wall Street today about the economy, of course, but it was an entirely different set of circumstances that got people nervous late this afternoon. Work in lower Manhattan slowed to a crawl when a U.S. Airways jet crashed into the Hudson River. The FAA says all the passengers and crew on Flight 1549 are safe. Ironically, they were headed to Charlotte, North Carolina, the home of Bank of America. We'll have the details from Wall Street when we do the numbers. It wasn't just Bank of America and the Treasury Department that were talking TARP today. It was a hot topic in the Senate, too. Back when it first passed the $700 billion package, Congress gave itself the right to stop the flow of money at the halfway point, and that is where we are now. With $350 billion out the door, a lot of lawmakers don't think there's much to show for it. The Bush White House asked for the second half of the money at the request of the president-elect. So even before taking office, the incoming Obama administration has had to convince enough senators things are going to change. Today they did. The Senate approved releasing that extra $350 billion. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Despite the government's huge rescue effort, the bank's financial plight is getting worse. And there's a lot of legislative second-guessing in Congress, including by Oklahoma Republican Senator Tom Coburn, who voted for the original TARP.
I've been fooled once by this present administration. They didn't do what they said they were going to do. They haven't been transparent with how the money's been spent. And now we're asked again, just trust us.
Instead of using TARP money to buy distressed mortgage assets from banks, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson shifted gears and bought equities in banks. The problem is, says Peter Wallison at the American Enterprise Institute, the bank's mortgage assets continue to fall in value.
What should have happened? The government should have valued those assets in some way and bought them off the balance sheets of the banks, replaced them with cash. If it had done that, the banks would be much more confident about the quality of their own capital, and they would be able to start lending.
Congress is looking for assurances from the next overseers of the TARP program in the Obama administration that they will target the remaining $350 billion at those mortgage assets. The incoming president's economic advisors have made written commitments to that and to broader accountability for the second half of the rescue money, money that with today's Senate vote is now available to the Treasury Department. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
All right, enough about the TARP. It's a mere $700 billion after all. Let's start talking real money here. House Democrats unveiled their economic stimulus package today, $825 billion as it stands now, but it is a safe bet to say it's going to grow. After it was released, the guy who's going to have to make the plan work, President-elect Barack Obama, called it a significant down payment. Marketplace's Steve Henn has the details.
What does $825 billion buy these days? For starters, tax breaks for first-time homebuyers and parents and anyone making less than $75,000 a year. Then there are tax write-offs for businesses with big losses and more than $500 billion in new spending on health care, cops, and new technologies.
We got to create jobs, not just for now, not temporary jobs, but for the future, and bridges and tunnels and rebuilding our schools.
That's Charlie Rangel, the Democratic chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. He's promising this package will create 3 to 4 million jobs in the next 2 years. That's a lot of jobs, but it's a lot of money out the door, too.
It comes to $217,000 per job created. Now, keep in mind that the average worker only earns $40,000 a year.
Brian Rydell's at the Conservative Heritage Foundation.
This is one of the most expensive pieces of legislation in American history, and it's being rushed through with very little congressional debate or analysis.
Just a year ago, $825 billion would have sounded like a fortune. These days, not so much. But for the record, it's 50% more than what the U.S. has spent on the Iraq War to date, and 10 times the cost of Hurricane Katrina. And this enormous price tag could go up. If senators protect the upper middle class from tax hikes under the alternative minimum tax, the cost is likely to shoot over $900 billion. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
I set up John Dimsdale's piece a couple of minutes ago by saying a lot of lawmakers aren't too pleased with the way the TARP has turned out. Oregon Democrat Peter DeFazio is one of them. We talked to him back when the TARP was first being debated. He's not technically a Blue Dog Democrat, but he is what you can rightly call a fiscal conservative, and we've got him on the line once again. Congressman, good to have you with us.
Thanks. Appreciate the opportunity.
We talked to you 3 months ago, Congressman, as the House was debating the original TARP bailout. Thought we'd give you a call again and see if 90 days worth of hindsight has changed your mind on that package and how you felt back then, which was none too good.
I was wrong. It was actually worse than I thought it could be.
Worse. Good. Lovely.
You know, what did we get for $350 billion? I mean, that's the question my constituents are asking. And that's now the question my colleagues, even those who supported it, are asking. And we're talking about right now debating a bill to put very significant restrictions on the future expenditure of funds. If only they had put those conditions in at the time and not put in the sort of Uber loophole, which gave Henry Hank Paulson the authority to do anything and everything he wanted to do with that money, and he sure did.
How are you going to vote this time when the second $350 billion comes up?
Well, first, today I want to see these very strong restrictions put in place, but I'm still not inclined to vote for it. I wanted two amendments that aren't being allowed. I would have split the money and said, okay, here's part of it. Let's see what you do with it. And then secondly, I still want to impose a minuscule transfer tax, something we had in this country throughout the Great Depression, throughout World War II, up into the 60s, on stock transfers. It wouldn't hurt people in 401ks and legitimate traders. It'd be 0.25%. So Wall Street could pay to bail out itself.
Is it that you don't think the bailout is needed or you don't like the way it's being gone about?
Well, I certainly don't like the way the first $350 billion was expended. I'm still not confident that even with these restrictions, we've got it right. And then even beyond that, I know that this vote in the House is not going anywhere in the Senate. So there will not be legal restrictions on the Obama administration. And at this point, the senators are saying, well, we got a letter from Larry Summers, and he told us how he'll spend it. And of course, we trust him. Well, I don't.
You're not buying it that the Obama administration and Congressman Frank, by the way, Barney Frank, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, has said they have an agreement on how this money is going to be spent.
Well, I'm sure they have told Barney and something, but again, I just don't think Congress should be giving that much latitude to the executive branch with that much money.
Speaking of spending a lot of money, you're also going to be voting in the next couple of weeks on a stimulus package. It came out today at $825 billion, likely to grow, I imagine. What's your feeling on that one, sir?
I'm disappointed. Everybody's talking about shovel-ready projects, and there's visions of sugar plums and bridges and transit systems and new water system dancing in the heads of many mayors and governors across America. I think they're going to be sorely disappointed when they see the small fraction of money in the bill that goes to those sorts of projects. Right now, what would be considered traditional infrastructure constitutes about 7.5% of the total $800 billion-plus expenditure.
Are you feeling any sense of urgency from the House leadership and the Obama administration on getting the stimulus package done?
Absolutely, and I think that's a mistake. We shouldn't be rushed, and there are some indications that there are enough of us concerned that we're slowing things down a little bit here on the House side, and we're going to push back.
No real doubt, though, that this thing's going to pass in some form, huh?
Well, I think there's enough of a doubt on, right now. I don't think you're going to find many Republican votes. If there are enough of us in the Democratic caucus concerned and saying this is not the right ratios, then maybe we'll see a different package.
Congressman Peter DeFazio, Democrat of Oregon. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, you could just chuck it all and run away to the circus.
Denmark, Switzerland, Poland, Germany, many countries. I'm a happy woman,
The life of a professional performer. But first, let's do the numbers. If you were looking for a day not to look, this might have been a good one. The Dow Industrials plunged below 8,000 early on and then bounced around. In the end, blue chips closed up a 0.1%, 12 points, finished at 8,212. The NASDAQ moved up 1.5%, 22 points, to settle at 1511. The S&P 500 put on 0.1%, that is a single point, finished at 843. Fears about financial stocks helped fuel the flip-flops. You try saying that 10 times fast. The Bank of America unloaded 18.5% today on news that it's seeking more bailout money. Citigroup, denying speculation that it would be nationalized, gave back 15.5%. Think about that phrase for a minute, denying speculation it would be nationalized. Wells Fargo took a 12.5% hit. J.P. Morgan retreated 6% after reporting a 76% drop in quarterly profits. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.21%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a simple guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for December. The Federal Reserve Board reports on industrial production for December. And it's Religious Freedom Day by presidential proclamation. It marks the anniversary of the passage in 1786 of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, penned by Thomas Jefferson. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There are all kinds of ways to try to understand the global economy. You can go big and tackle it at the macro level with supply chains and international trade deals, or you can boil it down to a single person doing a job trying to get by. Today on our series, working something a little different, the circus, the great Moscow State Circus, to be precise. Despite the name, though, it is actually a British company. It imports its performers from Russia. All year long, they travel up and down England, leading a fairly nomadic life, but one that is surprisingly domestic, too, as Marketplace's Sean Cole tells us.
Svetlana Sveistin's life with the Great Moscow State Circus is about as international as you can get. She's a Ukrainian dancer who performs an Argentinian cowboy act for English audiences with her Russian husband. She described the routine for me.
We play drums and turn a rope, and on the end is special small balls.
The ropes with the balls at the end are called bolas. Svetlana twirls one in each hand, cracking them against a special parquet floor.
We make ton-ton-ton with interesting sound.
With interesting sound?
Yes.
Her husband, Andre, twirls the ropes in his teeth. At the end of the act, he sets them on fire. They're like superheroes. They're dressed like superheroes. Spangly gaucho outfits, calf-high boots. The act is 6 minutes long. They do it twice a day, and as soon as they're done, Svetlana transforms back into her secret identity, rushing out of the big top and across the fairground to her camper. There's a bunch of campers and trucks all huddled around the tent like a circle of wagons. This is a small town south of London, and the circus is like a teeny meta-town. There are chores. At one point, Svetlana has to refill her camper's water tank with a plastic green watering can. Her 3-year-old son, Maxime, gets hold of the hose when we're not looking.
Ooh, whoa.
And sprays us.
That's okay.
The myth of the circus is that it's something you run away to. A family of little Svengalis who sleep late and chain smoke and drink until they break things. And it is that, to a degree. But it's something else, too. It's a mobile corporation. A crew of highly skilled professionals doing daily battle with inconvenience.
Can I look inside?
Yes, sure.
Svetlana's camper is about 6 meters long. The bathroom's just big enough for Andre to stand in by himself and shave with his electric razor.
Hi. How are you?
The generators shut down at 12:30 in circus camp and switch on again at 7:30 a.m.
So do you, the three of you sleep on this bed?
Yes, uh-huh. We sleep in now together. Because
Svetlana never imagined a life like this for herself, but she fell in love with Andre 10 years ago back in Kiev. She was a professional dancer in her early 20s. He was with the circus, always traveling. The relationship was doomed. Unless she joined the circus too. Their first tour was with a company in Denmark. She had never even set foot in a camper before, and now she had to live in one. A very, very small camper that had been sitting out in the cold all winter.
I was in shock. Everything was wet. I said to my husband, Andre, I don't know how we can sleep on this bed. It's all wet. And we had no pillows. We had no blanket. Nothing.
They finally found a blanket in one of the cupboards. It had a swastika on it. Things could only improve from there, and they did. She gets to travel.
Denmark, Switzerland, Poland, Germany, many countries, and I think I'm a happy woman, you know?
And last season, the Great Moscow State Circus enlisted Andre to be, I'm told, the world's first unicycling ringmaster.
Ladies and gentlemen, please allow me to invite you to the magical world of circus.
They're on the road 10 months out of the year. There are no animals in this circus, and they don't need them. They've got 11 springboard acrobats who fling each other into the air and land on each other's shoulders. They've got a guy who shoots balloons out of his wife's hands with a crossbow. Last I heard, they were going through a divorce. They've got Andre Aneskin, who's billed as Russia's last human cannonball. This was the most dangerous show I had ever seen. But it's also weirdly routine. Svetlana doesn't even show up at the tent until after intermission, midway through the 5-man trapeze act.
Ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
We're in the backstage part of the big top now. Svetlana and Andre practice a little before going on, stamping in place, twirling their drumsticks in the air. At the same time, the crew is dismantling the floor beneath our feet. It's the circus's last night in this little town, and everyone's eager to pack up, even while the show is going on. The electric screwdriver blends right in with the music.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning, the whole show is packed up into a fleet of big yellow trailer trucks, ready to roll. And Svetlana does some packing of her own.
I have to put all my kids' toys down because when we drive, it's everything fall down.
It's like battening down the hatches of a boat. She does this every few days, every time the circus heads to a new location. While we're talking, she bends down and picks up an electronic Etch-a-Sketch that can automatically erase itself.
You can, draw, yeah? Mm. Oh, it's my husband come. Da!
Andre and Maxime show up at the door, and they've been rooting around outside, harvesting.
My boy took blackberries, yeah? Ah, no, mushrooms! Oh!
Nice. It's a surprisingly normal life.
Yes, it's normal life for the circus artist and for me too.
But it's even normal for anybody, you know what I mean? To take care of your kid, cook.
Yes, sure, like all the people, all the world.
The season is over now. Svetlana and family are back in Kiev. She and Andre are working on a new act for next season. Essentially, they climb inside a man-sized hamster wheel and flip around in it as it rolls across the stage. It's sure to be a crowd pleaser, and to the audience, Svetlana's life will probably seem really glamorous. And it will be, for 6 minutes, twice a day.
Sean Cole produced that piece for us. Our series, Working, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. There are pictures and audio from some of our earlier profiles on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, and maybe I'm just too wrapped up in the fallout from the financial crisis to have noticed, but did anybody else know that Sundance starts today, that huge film festival, Park City, Robert Redford, that whole deal? Festivities got underway up in Park City, Utah this morning, but it is going to be an economically chastened crowd. Hotel and condo bookings are down. Parties probably won't be quite so over the top. And if you've got the hot indie film this year, well, congratulations to you. But you're probably going to have to hustle just that much harder to get yourself a distribution deal. We are distributed by American Public Media. The name of the program is Marketplace. Today, the Dow picked up 12 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ rose 22 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 jumped a point, a single point, 0.1%. Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, hedge funds are trying hard to comfort their investors. They're trying really hard.
Above all, we will survive because, unlike the fallen, our portfolios do not consist of great piles of manure.
They said it, not us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.